Welcome to yet another episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. This time I was very lucky to be joined by John, aka Borlaug and founder of the Borlaug Report. John knows a lot about the life sciences industry, so that's where we decided to focus the conversation on. The industry has gone through a rough patch post-COVID that has coincided with all the uncertainty related to the change in administration in the US. Some consider it to be peak pessimism, but we go over what makes this industry attractive long-term, diving into its different niches, especially fill and finish. Before jumping into the episode, remember you can find my work at bestanchorstocks.com. I share in-depth reports on high-quality companies and other investment-related recurring articles. In the show notes, you can find two free articles related to what we're going to talk about today. One is an in-depth report on Stevanato Group, and the other one discusses the role of AI in healthcare and why I believe this industry is poised to enjoy the benefits without suffering too many of the downsides. I hope you enjoy my conversation with John. So, John, welcome to the show. I'm very excited for this episode. I think I told you before recording that I think this will be probably one of the most popular episodes of the show. We're going to talk about a very interesting industry. I think an industry that's right now, we could say, probably out of favor and that has gone through quite a bit of volatility through the pandemic. We're going to be talking about healthcare. And more specifically about some subsegments of healthcare. So before starting, maybe give a presentation of yourself and tell the audience who you are.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here and have this conversation as well. So my background is I've been in public markets focused on healthcare and life sciences for the better part of 7 to 10 years, depending on what you count. Most of that in a public markets facing role. Last half decade or so has been largely buy side. I've been managing my own money like the rest of us for longer, but I've really focused on certain segments within healthcare. I don't invest in pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies, but I do love everything that operates around them. I do think healthcare is a pretty great space. So that's kind of where I'm coming from as an investor. I try to take a long-term lens, but obviously things move around more and you can't ignore the opportunities that creates. So the approach to investing that I've kind of taken into my writing and my work has also evolved over time.
I think people tend to talk about healthcare as this ultra large juggernaut that includes a lot of companies, but you tend to distinguish between healthcare and life sciences. So maybe tell us, what do you consider healthcare, pure healthcare, and what do you consider life sciences, and maybe the growth rates of both or the opportunities that you find that you can find in both?
Yeah. So the reason I make the distinction at all, and I guess the zoom out version, is that it all is really healthcare at the end of the day, but it pays to think about what makes healthcare attractive. You know, in terms of healthcare, you know, if you wanted to decompose the growth drivers of anything, if you start with any industrial company, right, there's population growth, you know, that kind of informs what consumer end markets will do, industrial end markets will do, just based on demand, right? So if you think about healthcare from a demand perspective, the odyssey of how you interact with the healthcare system in your lifetime starts off when you're born, you get vaccinations, you get a lot of care when you're a child. But then there's this period of time where you're young, but you're healthy and you don't interact with the healthcare system outside of emergency settings. And as you get older, obviously we age. And as you age, you become a bigger user of healthcare. And most of the healthcare spending that is done by a human happens in the last few years of life. So if you think about what really drives healthcare demand, your demand of the healthcare system, of hospitals, of drugs, of anything around it, it's aging. The other piece of it is chronic disease. So there's obesity. In the US, obesity rates have been in secular growth. But the way I think about healthcare from the attractive side is the aging piece more than the obesity. Obesity and the chronic diseases that it causes kind of compounds that, right? So there's a lot of debate today around, well, GLP-1s will deal with obesity. What will that do to demand for healthcare? And I think the counter argument is that it'll actually just prolong life. And a bigger aging population is still a secular driver. So there's puts and takes, but with that in mind, the healthcare players are really like the healthcare providers, the insurance companies, the drug companies, and the medical device companies, right? So the people who sell the treatments, people who deliver the treatments, and then that backbone that is the insurance system. Those are the players that really tie their volume demand to aging or anything else that's healthcare related. And it's important to kind of have a view on what's really underneath that, but that's the high level view. The reason I break life sciences apart from that is because life sciences is the ecosystem that serves pharma, right? So you have those four big players. The entire life science ecosystem really serves pharma in one way or the other. And it gets a little bit more complicated when you consider that life sciences also has applications outside of pharma, outside of healthcare altogether. So it has industrial end markets. You can use high-end analytical equipment to go and do quality control on your food, and you can test for drugs at the border, a fentanyl detection system. You see
here. I think there's also quite of overlap with semiconductors, right? Life sciences.
Exactly. Yep. Well, it's not huge, but it's there, right? So you'll see these guys talk about it whenever there's something happening. There's a point where people were really excited about cannabis, and PerkinElmer was talking about how they had quality control systems that were best in class for cannabis, where people thought it would be much bigger as an industry. So it's a more complicated slice, but I think the important part is that there are companies within that ecosystem that really they serve the pharma companies, and the pharma companies, while they grow with the healthcare demand, from a volume and revenue perspective, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to spend dollar for dollar or percent growth towards those companies, right? So it's important to know like who plays where, who's the variable costs that you can't do without. So that's why I make the distinction. I think it's an important one and explains a lot of what's happening today and will happen over the next 12 months.
So to understand that ecosystem, I think it's a good idea if we break, like you mentioned that humans are in contact with pharmaceuticals since they're born, right? Evidently, over the last years of their life is when they start to get more in contact with pharmaceuticals. But let's break down the full cycle of a pharmaceutical, right? Because I think a lot of people don't really understand how pharmaceuticals are made or all the process that it takes. So let's start with, and inside that full cycle, we can also try to break down the players that play a role and maybe what are the most interesting niches inside the cycle. So how does pharmaceutical manufacturing start? What's step one?
Well, I guess it starts before manufacturing, before you even have something to manufacture, right? So I think you and I both agree that manufacturing is the exciting part that I'm alluding to. But it really pays to think about how you discover a drug, right? So everything starts in academia and fermentation. When you are discovering a drug, you need something to discover first. So the way that starts is actually in basic lab, right? You're putting a diseased cell or tissue in a petri dish and having it interact with proteins or chemicals or things and kind of seeing what affects what. And at the same time, you're trying to find a target, something in the body that regulates your insulin, the quality of your bloodstream, any large number of things, right? So this is how we find things for cancer. And in the past, it's really just been this receptor regulates this. So in a certain disease, this receptor is not doing its job or it's doing its job too much, and that's causing the disease. And what you try to do is find a drug that affects the receptor in some way. It could be an inhibitor, which reduces the function, or an agonist, like in the case of GLP-1 drugs, where it makes it do its job more. And in the past, that's been largely a chemical function. We've been able to make drugs that are effectively just chemicals. A pill is a little tiny plastic capsule with chemicals in it. And those chemicals go through your digestive system. They find their way in the bloodstream, even if it's just a small percent. And those find their target ultimately. The chemicals, protein structures interact with this receptor that you're looking for that's designed accordingly. And then that's how you get your drug. But before you can do that, you need to know what you're looking for. So that happens in academia. It happens at big pharma companies in the lab. It's what I call basic R&D. And this is the part that kind of overlaps with academic work on semiconductors and basic, material science and stuff. So it's where you'll find all the Bunsen burners, the lab coats, basic equipment like that. And it's very, and it's tied to those budgets, right? But once something is found, that could be a novel target. It could be another way to hit a target. The university usually owns that IP and somebody will license it out of the university and start a company around it. Once the company's created, they might already have a drug discovered or they might start discovering a drug. So you know what you're trying to affect, you know what you're trying to make it do, However, you need to go find molecules that will actually do that. And you also want to make sure that they're safe for humans. So you start to screen things. You use what you know to kind of narrow it down. This is called you go from target discovery to lead optimization, right? So you find a bunch of candidates that look good, but you kind of weed out the ones you know will be really toxic. And once you have a handful of them, you start testing them on tissue samples, on animals, and you go from there, right? So these are all things that happen before you're ever in a clinical trial. Once you get to the end of that, you really have to go and show the FDA or, go ahead, sorry.
No, what I was going to say that.
Yeah, so once you're at the end.
After the lead optimization, then you go into the, you start the clinical trials, right? But there's preclinical and then there's clinical, right?
Exactly, yeah. So we're still not even into what people usually call preclinical. So all these things are really just going and saying, what am I actually going to put in a bigger animal, in a bigger study that I'm going to package up and send to the regulator? And this usually includes some of the drug discovery stuff. So there's a little bit of overlap with lead optimization and then everything that comes after. Then you'll do a lot of what's called toxicology or pharmacology. And these are just fancy words for animal studies, often on a primate model because of its similarities to humans, but depending on the disease. So some things are sufficient in a mouse or a hamster. It really just depends on where the literature is, and you could go into this rabbit hole for every disease. So once you've done that, you've done all the toxicology studies, all the chemistry work, you've tested it on a handful of NHPs, which is the abbreviation for non-human primate models. You go and create this data package that you submit to the FDA to get an IND filing done. I'm using the US example because it's simple, but there's an equivalent in Europe and everywhere else. And so once that's all taken care of, that's when you could start to move into the clinic.
And clinical pharma companies used to do clinical trials themselves, right? But they've been in an increasing trend of outsourcing these clinical trials to what we call CROs, right? The clinical research organizations. So maybe can you explain that process and also why pharma has decided to outsource much of this?
Yeah, so I guess if you rewind to the year 2000, about 25% of the animal studies, toxicology work, IND filing type work was outsourced, just a quarter of it. If you had talked to anybody, and that was mostly smaller companies, if you talked to big pharma and said, oh, you're going to outsource this, they would laugh at you because it was this mission critical thing that dictates whether or not a drug ends up in the clinic. You fast forward to today and it's over 60% for the same work. And that includes big pharma, right? So most of it is being done in an outsourced fashion. These are all things you can do at home, but if you take this and clinical trials and kind of put them in a big lump, you have to keep in mind what you need to get these things done, right? You need the infrastructure to keep animal models in a sterile, controlled environment. You need headcount, right? And then to do the clinical trials, you need a network of sites and staff to go and run these clinical trials. And you don't really know how many you'll need in a given year. And if a lot of big clinical trials all conclude at the same time, or if something stops working, you have all these staff that you still have to pay salaries to. And you're on the hook for that. It's kind of like capital intensity in that you deal with a capacity problem. So the way pharma has decided to solve for this is to outsource it, right? So by sharing this capacity risk with another provider and paying them a fifth, they get the flexibility back. So they still in-house a lot of it in clinical trials and safety studies today, but the trend has been toward outsourcing over the past 20 years.
And what do you think makes, and we're not going to stop a lot of time here, but what do you think makes a CRO attractive? Let's say, I mean, they also suffer, right, from labor intensity, let's say. In some sense, you could consider them to be some sort of consultancy companies, right? Because they are basically outsourcing the labor to these companies. Why do you think they are attractive? And what do you think is the growth profile of these companies?
Yeah, so in aggregate, it's really just the number of clinical trials that are outsourced. That's kind of how I would think about clinical CROs. And you can do the same exercise for preclinical, but there's only really a couple of companies that will give you that exposure. So I think it makes the most sense to just talk about the clinical ones. They're all pure play, 90% plus mix, et cetera. But it really is just the mix percent. And if you think about what those trials are, right? So we stopped at when it gets into the clinic. Phase 1 studies, they're small. They're short. They have very few patients compared to phase 2 and phase 3. So these CROs aren't even doing phase 1. They're just doing phase 2, 3, and four, which is after a drug gets approved, you have to monitor a certain set of the patients for longer. They're doing that for you. And they are taking some of that risk on. But as the complexity of what they're doing for you goes up, the value they add goes up, and they're able to capture better economics, right? But at the end of the day, to your point, they're still headcount businesses. You can look at these things from a revenue dollar per head. For example, if you compared IQVIA and ICON, the two largest public players, they're within 10% of each other on that metric, right? So that's not changing. It is price competitive, but there is this niche at the largest end, in the phase three, large phase twos, where not a lot of players can even properly do these studies. And they get more complex as you introduce things like genomics and biomarkers.
And what we, once the clinical trial is done and the drug gets approved, there's definitely some manufacturing in the clinical trial, but it's not evidently manufacturing at scale. Then the pharma companies have to start manufacturing the pharmaceutical at scale. So let's talk about that process, and maybe we can focus on biologics, right? Because it's probably the most appealing of the pharmaceuticals, the one with the most appealing growth rate. So how does the process, the bioproduction process, work?
Yeah, so maybe it pays to just kind of rewind and talk about what all drugs have in common from a manufacturing perspective, right? So no matter what kind of drug it is, there is an active pharmaceutical ingredient. So in pills, that's the chemical. In a biologic drug, it's usually a protein or cells of some sort. And as you go farther and farther along that spectrum to things like gene therapy, the molecules that the body is taking in get more and more complex, right? So the API is what we'll call drug substance. And then after that, it's really about packaging it, which means in the case of a pill, you're putting it in that little plastic pill, which goes into a bottle, which then goes into a box and is shipped to where it needs to go. But in the case of certain drugs, including especially biologics and vaccines, things are delivered in an injectable format, right? So they're in a solution that needs to be in a very sterile, perfectly controlled vial, withdrawn from a perfectly sterile syringe, and then included in an IV or directly to the body. So when you kind of think about that, that's what all drugs have in common. However, when you're making a chemical, there's not a lot that the life science tools industry can do, right? So this is where biologics comes in. To make biologics, you're usually basically just multiplying cells that create a protein for you. And so that starts in a small bioreactor, and you want to make sure that the cells multiply until the bioreactor is full, move it to a bigger one and a bigger one and a bigger one until you're at the last 2,000 liter bioreactor. That's called the production bioreactor. And it can be much bigger than that. We've had ones that are 50,000 liters for the earliest blockbuster drugs, right? So these all use specialized equipment. And the rate at which they use equipment that's sold by tools companies is going up over time, right? So in the past, it used to be these giant stainless steel vats, and you just wash them out and reuse them. Today, there's a disposable component, so you don't have to wash out your bioreactor. You can just throw out the bag. So these companies, I joked when I wrote about this, they're selling expensive trash bags and tubing to connect these bioreactors to each other. But it really seems simple and kind of hilarious when you think of it through that lens. So that's the substance process for biologics. If there was a version of this for small molecules, it'd be an attractive industry too, but there just isn't, right? And then once you get to the end of all of that, you're focusing on, all right, how do we get the drug into the patient? That's the fill finish / packaging process. And I think that's something that you and I have both focused on.
Let's talk, before we go into fill and finish, let's talk about the bio production process has two phases, right? Well, two big phases, which is upstream and downstream, right? What's the difference between both? And maybe what do you consider to be the mix of companies? Like, how does the mix of company differs from one to the other? Is there a company that does both great and can do the whole end to end? Or do the companies specialize in upstream or specialize in downstream?
Yeah, so I guess they all have different mixes. But if you think about what I just described with the bioreactors, that process is called scale up. Right. So the idea that you're putting the cells into a bioreactor with growth media that, you know, the conditions that make it multiply as fast as possible without compromising the drug, that's all the upstream process. Right. So what comes out of that last production bioreactor is a giant soup full of your drug. So the product is in there, but it's also in a solution with a bunch of other stuff that you don't want anymore. So the downstream process in bioproduction, this is excluding the fill finish packaging stuff that comes at the end, is really just focused on filtering and separating everything out and then creating a solution that can then be injected into the body. So there's like a concentration step at the end where they create the actual substance itself that includes the drug and whatever else is going into the syringe or the vial. And that's all just filters. There's these things called chromatography columns where they run it past a bunch of resins that will grab onto the drug and let the other stuff flush out. And that's all just a bunch of steps that do, okay, we're going to filter this out. We're going to filter this out. We're going to separate it. This will still be left. And you're basically just trying to get rid of the media, any viruses, any defective drug particles, just about anything that you don't want in a drug that's not the drug needs a different step depending on what it is. So the more different things that are in there, the more you have to do. That's why there's so many steps in that downstream process. But that's all it's really doing. It's just up to four different chromatography steps, a bunch of different filtration steps, and then you're done. There's other stuff like centrifuges and things that are, you're just trying to be creative, and it really is drug dependent. You know, so as far as who's the big player in those, I guess if you had to pick one that was over indexed in one direction or the other, right? So you have your big four, or Danaher, Sartorius, Merck, KGA, and Repligen. And then Thermo Fisher plays there too, and Avantor's there. Danaher is the one with the biggest downstream exposure. About a third of their bioproduction revenue is just chromatography. And then another 20-something percent of it is filtration. So that's all downstream operations, right? So they also happen to have broken into the market for freezer bags. So preservation comes after. But the rest of their business is just a hodgepodge of bioreactor exposure, tubes, and then they're really big in cell culture media as well. But that's really just exposure. It's not specialization. All of these companies are trying to create end-to-end portfolios. They want to be solutions providers. And the closer you get to that, the better things go. Sartorius will tell you that they're 50-50. Avantor and Thermo Fisher today are pretty focused on the upstream piece. And then Merck is an equal mix, but also has this CDMO business that kind of makes things a little bit more complicated. So that's kind of how to think about those. But at the end of the day, they are all bioproduction companies, and they're largely similar with the exception of Repligen, which I've written at length about and probably is a different topic. But the short version is they're trying to change how the process is done.
Is this a similar case to the CROs where pharma used to insource this part of the process and then they've outsourced it? Or did this, like biologics, when they started, it basically started outside of pharma?
So there is a mix shift dynamic if you think about the growth rates of the industry, but it's not an insourcing versus outsourcing as much as it is just kind of the mix shift of the molecules themselves, right? So you didn't need a lot of bioproduction equipment to make a small molecule, but the drugs are increasingly biologic today, right? So that's the tailwind behind industry volumes for this space. And then on top of that, you have this shift toward single-use technology. So wherever possible, you don't want to be, I guess if you wanted to call something in-housing or insourcing, it would be cleaning something yourself, right? Your bioreactors has got a complete run. It's empty now and it's full of residue and you want to clean it out. So you need a lot of water, electricity, chemicals in your facility dedicated, and headcount as well, dedicated toward just washing that out, sterilizing it, right? So I guess the outsourcing piece would be to pay for these disposables, right? So you can probably find equivalents in a lot of other industries as well, but that's kind of what's happening there. The mix is shifting towards these biologics, and these biologics are shifting towards smaller and smaller individual patient populations, which makes the case for single-use technology better and better and better over time.
Now, it seems like pharma overall is trying to simplify as much as they can the process and focus on what's most important, right, which is their R&D. And another place where they are doing something similar, right, is in fill and finish. So once you have the pharmaceutical, you need to store that pharmaceutical in vials, for example, and then, or maybe put it in a pre-filled syringe so that it can be administered to a patient. So I always tend to think of the fill and finish market as three things, right? You've got the glass or you've got the rubber, and then you've also got the delivery device, right? Those three things, in my view, are what most people are talking about. So let's talk about first, What the shift that's happening in the fill and finish industry, which is similar to the single use products in bioprocessing, right? So the industry is basically shifting from bulk products to ready to use products that are already And well, I'll let you explain what high value product is, because I don't think the name reflects what it actually is.
Yeah, no, you're one of the only people I've seen out there that's caught this, like what it really means. And it's interesting, right? Because if you think about what injectables are, they do include vaccines and small molecule drugs that needed them. So that's like a drag on volume growth. But every biologic is injectable in some way. You can't eat a biologic today. There are players in the industry trying to solve that. But the tailwinds behind this industry are also partially impacted positively by the rise of biologics as well. However, if you wanted to combine two tailwinds, this is where you play, because there's that outsourcing component, right? So in the past, pharma could just buy a ton of vials and a ton of stoppers, and then they would wash them and then sterilize them. Those are two different things, by the way. One gets rid of particles, one gets rid of germs. And then you put the stopper on, get the drug in there, and then you worry about the syringe separately. Other companies just sell plain syringes, so it's not that exciting. However, if you mess that up, it is a problem. It also is another one of those demand capacity problems where if your drug goes off exclusivity and you have this giant plant dedicated toward washing and or sterilizing all these vials that you bought in bulk, now you have a facility that's not doing anything anymore, right? So in some cases, you have a lot of different injectables and they all use the same vials and stoppers. Sure, there's a little bit of visibility there, but what we're seeing increasingly, especially because a lot of these smaller companies don't even have the footprint to begin with, is that they go to these companies like a West or a Stevanato and they say, we want something that's ready to use. And what that really means is that they want something that's already washed, it's already sterilized, and it's ready to just put the drug in, put it in the box and send it out. And that's really where the value is getting added. That's where this outsourcing mix shift is happening today. Ready to use is just outsourcing, you're washing and sterilizing. There's a higher end as well where performance materials are involved. But I think you can leave that aside if you really want to understand how great that space is.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people would have top of their mind what happened to West Pharmaceuticals I'd say already a month ago, maybe, yep. When they reported earnings, right? The stock dropped more than 30%. What's interesting is that maybe you can explain this, but West did not drop due to its pure, let's say, high-value product business, but due to a smaller part of their business that spooked investors.
Yeah, so it's interesting because all the big players in this packaging industry, they call things high-value products, but it's important to know, you know, the difference, right? I think you break things into three buckets, which is probably better than what I've been doing, but the way I've kind of done it is, there's containers and there's delivery, right? So the one thing that doesn't change no matter how you deliver a drug, if it's in a patch pump that's on your arm, if it's in a syringe through an IV, or if it's in a pre-filled syringe, it always has a container. So there's a vial or a cartridge. That's the part that never goes away. And that's a very consolidated oligopolistic industry today. The big four guys are all there. If I had to pick a space to be pure play, it would be that. And I think that's why Stevanato is really interesting. But the problem with West is that they have high value products in containers and delivery. Delivery is far more fragmented, a lot of different competition. And with that in mind, you have to go and scale up a next generation delivery device. And that's exactly what West is doing. So within HVP, it's not just 100% stoppers. Now there's this giant chunk of that that's just delivery devices. So they also have that and then a CMO business where they do manufacturing. So what happened on the quarter was basically in that smaller CMO business, they lost a couple of the CGM clients. So I guess it looks like Dexcom and Abbott are going to go make their own CGMs. And you know, that's just lost business that can be replaced over time, but it impacts the next 2 years, which is pretty near term, hurts margins, hurts revenue. That's all in guidance now. But the other piece was that the sell side seems to have missed, or I guess buy side too, right? Based on the stock reaction, had mismodeled what the real ramp underneath of those high value delivery devices was. And part of that was obscured by the creative economics they had in place with their large customer for the first product.
Best Anchor Stocks is brought to you by the Chit Chat Stocks podcast. That's right, another investing podcast you need to add to your listening rotation. My name is Brett, one of the hosts of the show, and I produce two episodes weekly along with my co-host, Ryan Henderson. On the Chit Chat Stocks podcast, we talk a lot of stocks, from the hottest names to undiscovered gems, interviewing sector experts, studying super investors and why they are successful, and having a fun time while doing it. Follow the Chit Chat Stocks podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, and never miss an episode. That's the Chit Chat Stocks podcast.
And let's talk about, because I think some people might be thinking, okay, these guys make glass, right? A glass vial. Why is it a great business, right? What makes it hard for new supply to come into the market? Why is it oligopolistic? I think let's talk about some, why are there these businesses so durable, right? I mean, they tend to trade at relatively high multiples. West has done phenomenally over a very long time. So what makes this a great business?
Yeah, so this is something that it shares with bioproduction, right? So when you enter your drug into the clinic, as early as the clinic, right? So you tell the FDA, here's my IND filing, here's what the drug does, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have to apply for a phase one study, and then a phase two study, and phase three. And when you apply for these, you start to build a document that specifies what is the drug, how do I know that the drug is pure and it's there, and then how is it made, right? Who gives me the tubes for this piece of the process, and who gives me the tubes for that piece? It's all in there. Every supplier is named, and you can name a backup supplier today. But what generally happens is you become quite reliant on just a handful of companies for that, right? So if those companies can't supply you with the adequate amount of tubes or vials or glass of any kind, that's it. If all of your suppliers in that FDA filing can't supply you, you can't make the drug without refiling with the FDA to add a new supplier, right? So that's a huge trust burden that they're placing on their suppliers. So yes, it's very easy to make high performance glass. You can go get some technology from, license something from Corning, build a nice plant and everything, but you still have to convince pharma to take that risk on you, right? So that's kind of the barrier. So in the past, things were a lot more of a commodity, right? You could buy bulk glass from any bulk glass maker if you're sterilizing it yourself. But when you add those layers of, I'm going to let somebody else make it, wash it, and sterilize it for me, the bar goes up and it makes the air a lot thinner at the top of the market. And if I were a big pharma company today, I would just choose these guys every time. It's a very small percent of the per dose cost of these drugs to go and pay a premium to each of the guys involved in your supply chain, rather than take a stab at somebody new. And you know, if you're the procurement guy at AstraZeneca or something, and you go and change to some startup glass company and it goes wrong, you lose your job, right? So there's a lot of these economic and career incentives across the board that just kind of interlock with each other, and it manifests itself as regulatory capture, right? Like, you can take all these risks, it's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. You can always change your supplier in bioproduction or in fill finish, but it costs money and time. And if you're the guy making it happen, you're staking your career on something that just doesn't matter.
If you want to switch providers, is it as hard in the containment solution than in bioproduction, or is it harder in bioproduction?
I guess if you have like a delivery device that's specified in, I guess that might be harder to change. But a lot of these things can be done. You just have to go and show, you know, what am I changing? How do you know it's going to produce the same exact drug, the same qualities that won't affect the patient? That just takes money and time. So it's always doable across all these companies, right? I could wake up one day and say, I don't want to use Stevanato anymore for my glass cartridges. But then I have to go and tell the FDA that. And I have to go and say, hey, here's these other guys that are using the process, and here's my filing to show them change. I'm spending $50 million in up to a year to change from one vial maker to the other to save a dollar a dose. Who cares? Mm-hmm. Not worth it. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in bioproduction, right? Like, these are just tubes and sterilized bags. You know, there's equipment, right? So some equipment performs better than the other, but a lot of these costs can just be passed on to the customer, right? So there's the capability to switch, but no incentive to do so, and plenty of incentive to just pass on any additional costs. The savings have to be pretty big, right? So part of my best idea thesis right now involves massive cost changes, but there's also other external factors that are driving that. In packaging until finish, it doesn't really exist, right? You don't spend a lot of money on vials, stoppers, delivery devices compared to the thousands you spend on every dose in the upstream, downstream stuff.
And we've talked about this before, but I think one of the things that makes fill and finish quite attractive is that the growth algorithm is very interesting and very margin accretive. So let's talk about that, right? Because a lot of people might be thinking, okay, I invest in a fill and finish company. What does the volume look like, right? But then when you start to look into these companies, really the volume is not the only driver of revenue, right? The underlying driver is mostly the transition that's happening from bulk to high value products. So maybe talk a bit about that and why do you think that, or maybe where do you think that this transition will land over the long term? I think Stevanato is around 40% already in high value products, something like that. So where would you say that ends up?
Yeah, so I think the short answer is it should be above 90% 10, 20 years from now. The other thing though to point out is that we're actually a lot earlier in this transition than that number suggests, right? So 40% of their sales might be in high value solutions, but if you go and adjust for the difference in pricing of those solutions, it's actually just like 10%, right? So I'll give you some examples from the piece I wrote on West inside of my primer. Bulk stoppers cost roughly like a penny, 1 to 2 cents. Their first cheapest high value product, the RU, I believe it's the washed only product. So it's not sterilized, it's just washed. I mean, 2016 was 10 cents, right? So it's 5 times more expensive. And then the RS, which is sterilized, was the only other piece that got meaningful traction at that point, was multiples of that. I believe it was triple from there. So 30-ish cents, right? So it's about 10 times more expensive, right? So you can make that adjustment. I don't have the line by lines for Stevanato, but if you think
Stevanato actually says the same. They say high value products around 10 times ASP compared to bulk.
Yeah, so it tracks with the West numbers. And I'm not surprised, right? It's a consolidated oligopoly industry. They all probably behave the same way because it's optimal. That's just how you operate oligopoly economics. But to keep that in mind, right? Like that means that even if 100% of the incremental volumes go to these high value products, it could be a couple of decades before you get, you know, the full mix shift. And if you go and kind of do the napkin math and what that means for top line organic growth, right? You don't even need actual pricing power, which these companies have, by the way. The mix shift on its own just creates this natural tailwind that gets you decades of high single digit or better growth for these companies in space. And it doesn't rely on volumes at all. If you look at West's long run plan, they're telling you high single digit organic growth. And of that, 1 to 2% is volume. That's share loss. They're telling you, hey, we're probably not going to win all the share in the market over the next, in, you know, over the long run, but we're still going to grow high single digit growth. And that's just a function of that, plus like a couple points of pricing, and then this big mix shift over time. And within the mix shift, there's a mix shift, right? It, you know, it's in 2016, most of West's high value volumes were just washed products, right? But eventually people don't want to sterilize their own products either. They want to keep outsourcing more and more of that. And that's where the economics show up. So even though the pricing's triple, there's still some capital intensity, but at scale, these things have high margins, right? So the margin benefit trickles down as well.
I think, well, I don't know how the numbers are for West or even if West discloses this, but Stevanato mentions that high value products are double the gross margin of bulk products. So you not only get 10 times the ASP, you get double the gross margin just because you're transitioning from bulk to high value products. And one thing that's precipitated, let's say lately, this transition is ANX1, right, the European regulation. So maybe can you talk a bit about that and why it has sort of accelerated the transition to high value products?
Yeah, so basically NX1 is a group of regulatory changes and clarifications that specify what you can and can't do to manufacture. So there were three ways to manufacture or to fill vials at scale, right? So these facilities could have an open line where humans could walk up and touch the things on the conveyor belt. There was, on the other end of the spectrum, a completely closed off version of that where humans have very limited access to the filling lines because these are all automated at scale. And then there was a version of that in the middle where you kind of reach into it with partitions in the wall and gloves and things like that. And one of the things Annex 1 did was outlaw the open filling lines. So you can't have an open filling line in Europe once those changes are in effect. And that's not really what affected this space so positively. The other stuff is what happened. There's a lot of disclosure required. All these things, here's how I'm measuring, monitoring, here's where I'm getting my vials. So to be a pharma company and have to wash and sterilize, you have to go and submit a bunch of paperwork to show constantly that you're properly washing, properly sterilizing. So that becomes very burdensome for pharma. And if you're going to set up your next set of production capacity for these to go and buy bulk vials and then wash and sterilize them yourself, you're thinking twice in Europe. You're saying, well, is this still a good idea now that I have to go and face all these regulatory burdens? And if I get raided and something goes wrong, I'm the only supplier of my sterilized product. That spells doom for me, right? So this is a risk that you can now outsource. So it's really made the value proposition of this high value trend a lot more high value in Europe.
And that the fact that it has happened in Europe actually has trickled down to the US, right? Because a lot of these companies are global and they are basically trying to do the same thing, or maybe they might be thinking that something similar might end up making its way through to the US. I don't know if that's accurate, or do you think that what has happened in Europe is going to change also the landscape in the US?
I don't know if I would underwrite that transition, like the same regulations being copied over. But I would say that if you think about what the costs are for running washing and sterilization operations, a big chunk of that is headcount, right? So in the US, the headcount is the most expensive that it is pretty much anywhere in the world, right? And that's why nobody makes a lot of small molecule substance in the US, because it's headcount intensive. And, you know, in addition to capacity and regulatory issues. And so if you put all that together, it just doesn't make a lot of sense already to do your own wash and sterilization in the US. And that's why there's so much capacity being built by, you know, the big four over there. Mm-hmm. So that incentive's already in place. I just thought in Europe, the headcount was cheaper, so you could kind of get away with it. But that incentive just got stronger. So it's actually catching up to the US, even if it's for different reasons. You're just raising the total cost of a smaller wash and sterilization or operation.
Let's talk about risks, right? Because we are probably making people think that fill and finish is the best industry in the world right now. I think it's a great industry, right? But it also has risks. I know you've read it before about, for example, GLP-1 volume, right? I mean, these companies have seen significant tailwinds from GLP-1s because in the pen injectors come with a cartridge, and evidently that cartridge is manufactured by the fill and finish companies. So maybe talk about GLP-1 volumes and also any other risks that you can think of.
Yeah, so I guess while we're still on Europe, I guess the first one is that PFAS is being banned as a chemical. That's something that's on the regulatory docket. That can affect a lot of the suppliers who use it, right? PFAS is everywhere. And these companies are coming up with alternatives, and there will be a phase out period. But if that law comes into place, that's a headwind in Europe, right? And it's, you know, given the landscape in the US right now, given who's running HHS over in the US, it's not crazy to think that we won't try to mimic that behavior in some way. Obviously, there will be puts and takes. There will be necessity will become a component of the conversation, but this is a transition that could actually change who gets all the share. So it's important to kind of be aware of that. And then the other piece to your point about GLPs is really the reason these volumes are better than owning a drug company, in my opinion, is why I spend all my time here and not on pharmaceuticals, is because you get to basically aggregate all of the demand from the entire industry for certain categories of drug. And that really says a lot more about the industry than a single drug, right? You could say gene editing is great, but if all the gene editing companies fail, you're wrong. But if you get the one that works, you make a lot of money in gene editing, right? So there's a different game you're playing. And that game you play in bioprocessing can mean, you know, you're overexposed to a gene therapy like Repligen, currently is today, where they have a big exposure to Sarepta's drug. But in the case of the fill-finish companies, it's GLP-1s, right? Because they're using the high-value products, right? We just talked about how there's 40% mix, but 10% volume mix. That creates a lot of exposure to GLP-1 injectables, right? So in the case of West, for example, they say that 5% of their products business is GLP-1 or mid-single digits, and then 40% of their contract manufacturing, right? And that rolls up to a high single-digit exposure. That's great if you think that we're all going to be injecting GLP-1s forever. But if you have an oral version of that drug, that demand becomes a headwind at some point in the future, right? So it complicates the story. It starts to make it so that you need to have a view on GLPs. And as an investor personally, who doesn't want to touch pharmaceutical companies, I try to avoid having to have those opinions. So it's made it harder for me to own fill-finish companies than it has been for certain bioprocessing companies, just because of the inherent risks that GLP has brought in. It also makes me smack my head for not being involved for long enough when GLPs first emerged. I owned West and Stevanato in my personal account a long time ago when they were trading at like 30 times earnings. This is like, late 22 or 23, I guess 23. And then, you know, the GLP thing happened and these stocks kind of worked when nothing else in space did. And I wish I had stuck with it longer because I didn't fully appreciate the magnitude of that opportunity. But now a lot of it's in the numbers and there's other headwinds that we're working through, and you have to kind of balance those two against each other. But my early take on the GLP stuff is that we're still a pretty long way away from orals and they'll have a hard time taking the whole market.
I think we've marginally touched on this, but what's the limitation for oral, both GLPs and oral biologics in general?
Yeah, so today the GLP drug is not a biologic. It's kind of like a big small molecule, right? Where peptides kind of fall between, but they're made in different ways. So the two major players in this market are Lilly and Novo. Novo uses fermentation to make it, so it looks a lot like a biologic production process, but they don't use a lot of biologic production equipment. They use some like downstream stuff from the industry, but it's a small part of the pie. Lilly, on the other hand, does it chemically, right? So they do chemical synthesis to make tirzepatide, and that's a lot easier, a lot more scalable, but that's kind of the puts and takes. They're not biologics today, but Lilly also bought a company that makes a monoclonal antibody, right? That's supposed to have better weight loss, better muscle outcomes. So you can kind of see where this is going, where you don't want to lose muscle when you lose weight. So there still needs to be innovation in that direction. That could change what the molecule package looks like. It could be peptide plus biologic. It could be peptide plus small molecule. That all remains to be seen, right? So that's just the injectable conversation. So we still don't know what those molecules will be, but those innovations probably have to be injectable first. Then you have this question of oral drugs, right? So when you ingest a drug, this is the reason you can't ingest the most monoclonal antibody drugs today, right? Is they're big, sensitive molecules. They have to go through the digestive system. The percent of the drug that makes it where it's supposed to go in the body, right, to the GLP-1 receptor, or, you know, in the case of not, you know, drug to the tumor cells or something, the digestive system kills like 90-something% of the drug, right? So then the remainder gets there, which means you have to take it either more frequently, or you have to take a bigger dose. And that's why most of the biologic drugs, they are delivered via IV, right? But the self-injectables, for example, you're injecting them into a thin layer of muscle. You're not actually going into your bloodstream directly. So it's kind of somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. That all said, you can get an oral version of a peptide into your system today, right? Rybelsus is Novo's diabetes drug. That technically does have, it's a GLP-1 agonist. GLP-1 receptor agonist, but you have to have a diabetes prescription for it. It does have some weight loss. It's not that great. But the new drugs that they're trying to bring to market are looking to compete on how much weight you can lose. But therein lies the setback, right? You need more of this drug, right? So what you're doing is, if you're taking more of a drug, it stands to reason that you're taking more of the side effects in as well, right? So in this case, that's nausea, vomiting. There's been reports of like depression and things, but those are more niche. It's really about the nausea and vomiting. At some point, you have to wonder if patients will adhere to a drug. Drug adherence is already a problem. If you have a daily pill that makes you nauseous, you might avoid it on certain days. That might affect your outcomes. That might affect how willing insurance companies are to pay for it. a whole host of downstream costs kind of come with that. And then to make matters worse, you have to produce 50 to 100 times more of the molecule, which could put a huge strain on the already strained manufacturing capacity of the industry today.
Do you think, besides putting strain on the manufacturing capacity, is it much more expensive to do more of the drug, or is it just marginally more expensive because you are doing it in big volumes either way?
How do you mean?
So, for example, if I have to do twice the amount of the pharmaceutical so that it has the same impact in oral, is it twice as expensive or is it less because you evidently have scale benefits?
Well, I mean, if you take the fill-finish injectable process out of it altogether, you probably save a sizable amount of money. But it remains to be seen, right? Like we don't know the pricing for a commercial GLP-1 obesity drug yet. But it's also worth pointing out that Lilly and Novo have been starting to compete with each other on price. Like price is just kind of coming down on its own anyway. So given the fact that it's not a complex biologic drug, it's made chemically, injectables aren't that much more expensive anyway to make. You know, multiplying the substance requirement doesn't necessarily net out to anything other than the same. It just depends on the market. And if you think about it from Lilly and Novo's perspective, this is partially a consumer product. Insurance is not going to foot the entire bill for this all the time. And that's why the whole industry is designed to get around a lot of the prescription and insurance requirements. But that requires price control. So, you know, if you think that Lilly couldn't make it cheap enough, that's going to be a limiting factor too. But the other piece is really just how much weight you lose. You know, taking a pill every day to get you nauseous to lose less weight than the injection might not be worth it. So there's a lot of questions to be answered in the future. But as we kind of progress through the growth curve of the injectable GLP-1s, you still have to answer that question, or at least have an opinion to know what you're
doing. I mean, we're already seeing that people are leaving the drug, right? I mean, I don't know what the retention is after one. And that's already with maybe less side effects that an oral drug would have, right? So maybe with more side effects, the retention would drop to close to zero, maybe after 1 year or something like that.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean you can't get a benefit from it, but it does impact, you know, how many people will have access through their insurance because the outcomes aren't as good, right? Like these insurance companies, regulators, they all compare things on a cost basis, right? So if I'm spending $500 to $1,000 a month to inject GLP-1 drugs, and I don't lose a lot of weight, but I do lose weight, how much of that weight loss is turning into savings for the healthcare system, right? Mm-hmm. So if I have a slightly above average body mass index and I only lose 5% of my weight, is it really going to impact my health outcomes? It's not clear.
So John, thank you very much for coming to the show. I think it's been a great conversation. I think people could probably tell that we like the fill and finish phase after this episode. I wanted to ask you a question. Besides the Borlaug report, which is your subject and which I recommend, I think it's exceptional if you want to learn about life sciences. What would you recommend as a source for people to learn about the industry?
Yeah, I think so. I'll start with the way I learned the space, right? I think I probably was the single largest Googler of all terms in pharmaceuticals and bioproduction. I try to create these primers to kind of give everyone an understanding of what's what, right? Like monoclonal antibodies are the biggest biologic, even though gene therapies are sexy and exciting. It's really about mAbs today. So once you understand that stuff, and I would recommend my own writing for that kind of knowledge. There are good primers and initiations out there from cell side research. Once you've done that, it really pays to kind of follow the industry broadly, right? So if you want to follow trends, there are websites like Bioprocess Online or Bioprocess International. It might be cousin websites. I have no idea why their names are so similar. But then also follow what the actual industry is doing. And you can do that with STAT and Endpoints. Those are the two biggest publications in the space for biopharma, right? So they all talk about who's doing deals, who's acquiring, who's licensing, who's building manufacturing capacity. So seeing how they behave has helped me kind of follow the space closely and put together a mosaic that's helped me form ideas over the years.
And I don't know why, but a question just popped into my mind, and I think it's an interesting one. There's a lot of discussion around AI and healthcare. Where do you think the opportunities lie for AI in healthcare? And how long do you think it will take for AI to make a meaningful impact on healthcare?
Yeah, so I know a lot of people who are more excited than I am about AI and some people who are less excited than I am. I think where I shake out on it is it really is data in, data out for the discovering a drug piece of things, right? So everyone says AI will go and solve all of our needs from drug discovery. But the problem goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, right? You need to know what targets you're trying to hit, right? So we have data on the existing drug targets today. And AI companies, at least the ones I've followed so far, have done a lot of work trying to find a molecule that we couldn't find with human eyes that would still hit that target, right? But the number of use cases that that creates, it could be niche, right? A lot of these are like, go find a copycat drug that also hits the target without stealing somebody's IP. Is that valuable? Do we need more copycat drugs? I would say no. We have tons of them today. Lots of companies going for the same cancer targets, right? Like that's one of the big bear cases on biotech is that there's like 30, 40 companies targeting all the same inhibitors. So, you know, with that in mind, it kind of seems like we need to wait to see if we can get beyond that. We need to figure out the data generation piece. So what they're doing today is finding a molecule that will bind or affect X faster than a human can do it, but it's only relying on, you know, what target you need. It's not discovering new targets just yet. And maybe we'll get to a point where that happens before the drug discovery process starts. But if you think about what happened, you know, like how do you predict if it's going to work on the patient? That's where we have a big gap in data. Everybody's clinical trial studies, you know, they're using data that they have, but everyone else doesn't have it. It's not in academic literature. Mm-hmm. The NIH studies aren't being funded to run phase 3 clinical trials. That's big pharma, right? So big pharma has a lot of that data. But the question is, do they have enough? So what you've seen from the early drugs, I guess like I'll point to Recursion, for example, they're one of the big first movers in this AI strategy. They started before it was cool, which is cool for them. But what it kind of seems like is happening is they're really good at predicting safe drugs, but not necessarily efficacious drugs, right? So then that's the drug discovery question, right? So I think we need more data is kind of the short version. Otherwise, I'm unconvinced that it's going to make a meaningful near-term impact. The second piece of that is the regulatory bottlenecks. You still have to go through clinical trials. That's a problem. That slows everything down. So this isn't really as here today as like an agent might be, right? But if you think about it from every other perspective, AI is going to have the same benefits in biopharma as or healthcare broadly as it will anywhere else, right? Which is making humans more productive, more efficient, giving them tools to do things faster. That might introduce risks. But if you think about it from a CRO perspective, right, a headcount business, if you have a scaled organization with more productive headcount, you could see a world where clinical trial staff at a CRO can do more clinical trials per person. So some of those benefits will go to pharma, but the economics will also benefit CROs as well. There's a long and windy, complicated question around this, but that's kind of how I'm framing it today.
Do you see a potential benefit of AI in bioprocessing, in the manufacturing of the pharmaceutical, in trying to make it more efficient, or?
I guess it pays to know the history here, right? Until the last 5 or so years, the management of these production processes wasn't even well digitalized. So we were in the Stone Ages, right? Like a lot of these things were like notebook, like QA/QC notebooks hanging next to the bioreactor or something and being signed off on by staff. But, you know, companies have moved to make analytics embedded in those processes. So we're still there. But if you think about like what AI could do, it could be something to the tune of like predicting when a batch or when a filter needs to be changed or when a batch is going bad before it actually goes bad based on that. But I think we do a lot of optimization upfront today. So it's not clear to me that the biggest benefits will land there. It'll be used. I'm sure people are trying, but I think the big opportunities are, you know, like making clinical trials more efficient, taking headcount out of these operations, and then discovering better drugs faster. Those are kind of the top three. And I'm not saying we're there yet, but those are the places everyone's going.
Makes sense. Thank you very much, John, again, for coming to the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.